The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I talked a little bit about ways that people can meet, especially meet in some deep way. What does it mean for two people to meet? And I thought today, earlier I thought today I would follow up on that talk with other aspects of how people meet and talk about how people talk with each other, what happens in conversation. But what I'd rather do is to save that for a few weeks. And for the next, today and for the next 2 weeks, give a series of talks on leading up to speaking. And because speaking is a big topic, you want to prepare yourself for it. And so I thought today I want to talk about the practice of solitude. And then next week, the practice of listening. And then in 2 weeks, talk about speaking. With the idea that our speaking, why is speech, ability to speak and really connect to someone, is very much supported by having an ability to be solitary, to be able to rest in oneself in a deep way. And that if we can rest on ourselves, content and happy, then it's easier to listen. And perhaps listening is more important than speaking. But anyway, listening is preparation for speaking. And so so I thought next week we'll talk about listening, and then in 2 weeks, actually speaking itself. So then today the topic is solitude, and that's a topic which some people, the idea of solitude, some people love solitude, they have really wonderful associations with it, and some people are, it's disturbing, the whole very concept of solitude. Solitude is given as punishment to people. And in fact, I met a man on Friday. On Friday I went to San Quentin. And the first time, I go to San Quentin for a visit every year, and for the first time I've been there, I went to death row, and that was interesting to meet. There's 700 people, 700 men on death row in San Quentin, and so it's a lot of people, and they're all stacked on top of each other, on these tiers, going up and up and up and up, and they spend most of their time in little cells, and and you know, I was able to walk into one of the cells of the men in solitary. They got out, so I can go in. And it was a little room that's about 9 feet by 5 feet. And the men in solitary on death row, they have it good in terms of accommodations, because in the regular prisons, the same size cell is used for two people. So some people have closets that are bigger than that. And 9 by 5. That includes a toilet and a bed. So, but not in solitary confinement, another part in prison, I met a man who had turned his life around dramatically, and that was a beautiful person. But he had been like one of the toughest or the worst of the worst, and he explained how bad he was. He said, I went to prison, and then I committed a crime in prison, and for that I was sent to Pelican Bay. And then I committed a crime in Pelican Bay, and for that I was sent to solitary confinement. So that's about as, you know, you can't go much further down into solitary. So some people say solitude is very frightening. It's alienating, lonely. For some people it's beautiful to be in solitude, go off. For some people going off and being alone in the high Sierras is one of the high points of their lives. Some people, the idea of being home alone is frightening and lonely and depressing. And for some people, it's a relief. Solitude, I think, you know, I think it's something that's very valuable to cultivate as have a capacity for joyous solitude or peaceful solitude, so that solitude becomes a refuge and a support for us. And for the people who are most challenged by solitude, it's probably a sign that that's one of the really great tasks in life, is to work with that and somehow work with the issues that come up, the fear that might come up, There are people who are really afraid of being alone, because if they're alone, I've had people tell me that if they're alone, not connected to people, it feels to them like they're annihilated, like they don't exist. And so it's very, they always have to be with people to kind of be, find out, that to prove that they're that they exist even. And you know, it's so it, for those people, it's even a bigger task, the idea of what does it mean to be find your peace being alone. For me, the first time that I really learned to love solitude was when I was 21, I believe, and I lived on a small dairy farm in Norway, and it was a small farm with, and it had actually only 5 cows and some calves, and I was living there with my friends who were the farmers, and they left for a week and left me in charge. And it was up and tucked away in a little valley and the end of a road. And I wasn't planning to be alone. It hadn't occurred to me I was going to be alone for a week. But in fact, I was alone for a week. And the only person I saw for the week was in the distance. I saw the mail carrier walking up the road in the distance. Otherwise, there was no contact with anyone. There's, I suppose we had a phone, but I don't think anybody used it back then for anything serious, you know, like they do now. And you know, for a week, I didn't talk to anybody, and except for the cows. I talked a lot to the cows. And what happened to me was, you know, it was kind of naive. I wasn't thinking about anything but, you know, the value of being alone. But in the course of those 7 days, I found myself getting more and more peaceful. And I found myself more and more acutely aware of my awareness becoming more acute, my sensitivity or attention. And I became more and more aware of the world around me. And something, the world around me started to sparkle. It was like really amazing. Just, I think it felt so vivid, like some people can have on retreat. And it felt so precious just to be there and walk around and look at my cows. And then I became acutely aware of my own thinking in a way I'd never before. My own thinking, my feelings. And it was the acuteness, the clarity with which I was aware of things, which that really struck me as something spectacular. And a kind of sense of well-being and happy. I never would have thought that was possible. And then when I my friends came back, all that faded away. And so then what I made it my task, my question, was not to go off and be a hermit. That didn't seem to be in the cards, didn't seem like right. But rather, how to have solitude together with other people. How to have ability to have that kind of intimacy with myself, that kind of feeling of peace and restful here, while I'm with other people as well. Not aloof from other people, but you know, connected to other people. And I saw in myself, and I saw many other people that I kind of knew, that it was a hard thing to do. That there was a lot of social games that goes on, a lot of manipulations and agendas going on in the act of communicating and talking and all kinds of things you want. And it's, you know, it's commonly pointed out that some people have a very hard time with silence in conversations, and they try to fill the silence as quickly as they can because they get uncomfortable. It was interesting. Recently I met a woman who, when she was 17, she said she met her husband. Well, they met before they got married, and met on one day, and I think it was 4 days later, he was 2 years older, she was 17, he proposed to her. And she said, "Of course, I said yes right away. But the reason I said yes was that he was so sincere. And I thought there was only two possible answers, yes and no. I didn't want to hurt him." He said, now I realize I could have said, "Well, that's really sweet that you asked, but I need to think about it for a few days." But back then it was just yes or no, and I had to kind of take care of him in the conversation. And so, but, you know, I had to say yes, taking care of him. they've been happily married for 50 years, so that worked out. But but you know, what a way to begin. So the feeling we need to take care of other people, or feeling we need to get something for ourselves in the relationship, to you know, not be lonely or to be seen a certain way. And to cultivate solitude is to cultivate the ability to feel at peace with oneself, be at ease with how one is, as one is, without needing to be seen any special way by other people, not needing to prove oneself to other people, not needing to maybe defend oneself from other people if other people have wrong impressions of you, that somehow you're a person, you're secure in yourself, that you're just willing to be here as you are. I think it's one of the great capacities of life is to have that ability. I think meditation practice is basically a solitary practice. Even if you meditate together with other people, which is a very profound thing, and you can feel very connected when you sit next to someone. I once sat next to someone during a 7-day retreat, and so... it was Zen practice, his eyes are open, so you kind of see the person peripheral of your eyes, and I could see the person breathing, and I kind of tuned into the person's breath, and then I fell in love with her. And then we were partners for a couple of years. But you know, so it's not gonna, you can't, you know, it's, you know, how alone was I? But I think in principle, at least, you know, meditation is, you know, kind of a little bit, you know, something you do for yourself, a little bit solitary. You can feel connected to other people doing it. But the idea of, you know, closing, basically in our tradition, closing your eyes into yourself, and then learning how to be alone and be peaceful, how to find a sense of well-being, and for some people, a profound level of self-acceptance as we are, not who we should be, or who we think we're supposed to be, or how we have to prove ourselves to be. And having that capacity and to have confidence in it, then allows us to enter into relationships in a very different way. It allows us to enter relationships without needing to play the games of that we try to play. And hopefully, at least for me, I think the goal is not to hide in solitude in that capacity, but in doing so, to be more honest in our relationships to other people. I've known people who've done a lot of Buddhist practice who unfortunately use the solitude of Buddhism to escape into. Because then you don't have to deal with people. And there are some people who don't want to deal with people. And so Buddhism is a great escape. you know, it's rather unfortunate, I think, but that does have, for some people, that's how it works. Maybe some of you have used your Buddhist practice as a way of escaping rather than dealing. There is a strategic retreating that's useful, but using Buddhism as an escape, and it's possible for years, you know, in certain Buddhist traditions especially, to kind of enter in, just kind of be solitary and self-contained, and so not, and be impervious to other people. When I practiced for about 3 years, or more, 4 years, at the Zen monastery, where it was all the practice was a group practice. I mean, basically, you get up in the morning together, you meditate together, you would chant together, you eat together, you work together, and your whole day is kind of choreographed in a particular schedule. And so, when you live that way, it was really easy to get up in the morning to meditate, because everyone was doing it. It was just kind of that was going on. And so, and I would meditate a lot because in the monastery there was a lot of meditation. And what I didn't realize until I went to Thailand to meditate there was how much I had relied on the group momentum to keep me connected, involved in practice. It was a lot easier to be disciplined when you had a whole group of people around you who were doing the same thing. And when I went to Thailand to practice the first time, I came to a monastery and I told the abbot, I'm here to practice whatever it is you do here. I didn't even know what I didn't have any idea what he did. I didn't know what Vipassana was even. And I was a Zen priest. I'd done years of Zen practice, and I just thought that in Thailand they have this interesting meditation, I heard, and I'll just see what they have. I'll see what they have to do. So I showed up, and I just happened to be in Thailand. And so I said, "Tell me what to do." And so he gave me a little hut in the edge of the monastery to practice alone. And day and night, in this little place, it wasn't 5 by 9, but it was probably 8 by 8 or something. And then I was really surprised very quickly that now my practice, I had to rely on my own discipline and my own motivation, my own intention. And I realized only then how much I'd relied and depended on the group, what they did. And so then, alone, day after day, it was 10 weeks alone that way practicing. And how is it for 10 weeks to keep the momentum going, keep the discipline going? And so I had to kind of find it in myself. And so part of the value of solitude is to find something powerful in yourself, maybe a strong intention, what's really important for oneself. There are some things in life, I think, about ourselves that are very hard to know about oneself unless we're somehow have a lot of quiet time to be left alone. I believe that there are really quiet and shy aspects of our personality, of who we are, that don't really show themselves until we really allow ourselves to be deeply quiet. But deeply quiet in a way that we're able to drop a lot of our preoccupations, a lot of our fears, a lot of our desires. And one of the reasons why solitude, I think, is very difficult for many people is that they're not able to drop their fears and their desires and their wounds, the ways that the pain that they carry from maybe having rejected earlier in life and maybe been alienated or left alone or sent to the room too many times. I've heard, you know, it's really sad. I hear these horrible stories. As a meditation teacher, one of the things you do is you hear terrible stories. I'm receptacle of terrible stories of what happens to people in life. And it's quite something. And but you know, being, you know, it's quite something to be abandoned by a parent when you're young. You're left alone. And that loneliness kind of gets carried with us into life. I knew there was one person I met. His mother got really upset with him and his sister. He was just, I don't know, 4 or 5 or something. And she didn't mean it, but it wasn't for real, but she didn't tell him this. She got really upset, so she packed her suitcases and walked out the door and around the block. But you imagine what a 4-year-old, you know, the mother's leaving. I mean, what a thing. Came back 5 minutes later, but 5 minutes was probably an eternity. And so that, you know, carry that into solitude, you know, what does that mean to be alone then? And so sometimes solitude is a place we have to meet what some people call our demons or what's really difficult and dark. And I've known people who have gone into solitude and it was a wrestling match to do that. You know, you break out in a sweat trying to deal with what comes up. It's not necessarily easy, but to work through it, the difficulties, and then to be able to sit and be comfortable here and to find peace or well-being. Or what I found was a very deep intimacy with myself and the world around me. When I went to the Zen monastery the first time, to live there, they have this, there's a tradition in Zen where when you come, you're new to the monastery, you have to prove to the people there that you're worthy, that you're serious. It's kind of like a Zen hazing, I suppose. and so what it entails is, it depends where you sit, but like where I was at Tassajara, you sit in the meditation hall. In Japan, where I did have to do the same thing, you sit in a little ante room, the entryway, just a little room there. And and you're told to go sit, meditate there until they tell you you can stop. And in Japan, it was you're supposed to sit there from 7 to 14 days. In Tassajara, I think, when I was there, I think it was 5 to 10 days or 7 to 10. I don't remember how long it was, but it was long. And you know, you'd have to get up at meal time and take a little break, like half an hour after you eat your meal, so you can go to the bathroom. And you get allowed to sleep at night. But otherwise, you just have to sit there. You're supposed to sit there and not move for 3 or 4 hours. And it's quite difficult. And, you know, if you don't move for that long, it's mostly difficult because of the pain. So I spend many days sitting there, you know, with the pain, the pain, the pain. I don't recommend it. But it was very valuable for me because it was another time in my life where I felt so intimate with myself. I felt like I knew myself so well because I had to, in order to survive, cope with all the pain that I was feeling. I had to stay really, really present. If I wasn't present, I would suffer. If I drifted off from the present moment, then the pain would just kind of take over and I'd feel so much self-pity or anger, all kinds of things. But if I stayed really present, then I wouldn't suffer. And so I felt so connected to myself, so much so that you don't know when it's going to end, right? You know, it's like this, you know, variable time, you know. They tell you, it ends, you know, they're watching you a little bit during it. And so if you sit well, you can sit for less. But if you fidget a lot or move a lot, then you're going to sit longer. So you're motivated to sit still. So I remember they finally came and tapped me on the shoulder, which I knew what that meant, you know, oh, it's over. And I started crying because the thought that came to my mind was, I'll never be this intimate with myself again. That I felt there was going to be a loss, you know, even though I was glad not to have the pain anymore. It's just, oh no, that intimacy. So for me, I associate this solitude with intimacy. Someone else maybe with peace and well-being. So what does it take to discover this, you know, the joy or the benefit or the happiness of being alone? Is an interesting topic. So what do you think? What do you think it takes to discover peace or happiness in solitude? So I'd like to hear from some of you.
Motherhood.
So then motherhood, meaning that you have so little opportunities for solitude that they're all over you and,
exactly.
You know, just give me a break.
I used to be jealous of my husband's commute to work.
Uh-huh. So just because he's alone in the car for, until he gets to work, yeah. Thank you. So what else does it take? No one knows here. Yes, Martin, will you take the mic?
One word. I think it takes, I would say, kindness.
So it takes kindness. Uh-huh. Okay, good. What else? I'll call on people. Renee? Is there a mic over there? Over there, Marilyn has a mic over there. Green light.
I don't like solitude, but when I'm really busy and I'm at work, seeing a lot of people all day long, I really appreciate my peace and quiet at home. So I think it's the contrast.
So a contrast
of being really, really busy and then having that quiet time.
So it's a little bit like motherhood. It's also the contrast.
Oh yeah.
It's in which case then the solitude is a relief. And what is it? So one of the very interesting differences. Is a difference between relief and release. And some people look towards like spiritual practice for relief from something, It's very different to be released from something. So if motherhood was not a challenge, or there was no motherhood at all, or no, you know, then what, you know, how do, what would solitude mean then? How to find peace then, when it's not just a relief from something that's challenging? Yes, in the front. Right, if you.
I think for me it's appreciation. So even if I am in solitude, if I'm in nature, it's kind of contradictory since I don't really feel like I'm in solitude, even though there are no people around me, because I feel appreciation towards the environment or where I am or my body or the fact that I can sit and be alone.
So. Beautiful. So appreciation. And some people say gratitude is an important quality, to be able to appreciate. Thank you.
You know, I've often thought about the people.
You have to turn it on.
Yeah, it needs to be a green light, then it's on.
No, it doesn't work. I've often thought about the people who have solitude forced on them and then lose their mind. And I've often wondered if I didn't have some of the techniques that we learn to deal with solitude, I'm not sure it would work as a beautiful thing.
So the techniques we learn of mindfulness, for example, makes it possible to appreciate or find valuable or in solitude, or at least not go crazy, because there are people who go crazy with that. Mm-hmm. Right behind you. So before we do that, maybe I can ask you another question. What techniques have you learned that you think that are most useful for you? Well, would serve you best if you were put in solitary confinement?
I think at different times I've appreciated different techniques. Mm. Right now, I think the ones that are most helpful are exploring my own feelings or reactions to things.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. I think we should turn, at least leave it on, probably. Once the screen, we're passing it around.
One thing that you told the other day that I think I haven't been, it was very useful to me. You said that we have to come to terms with our, when you're meditating or trying to, which is my case, and something comes up and it insists coming and it's something like a fear or something big. Instead of trying to shut it up, you better just come to terms with it and face it. So that, to me, relates to what we're talking about, because to me, being alone, it's also being with my thoughts a lot and far from everyone. And that is very useful to me, to be able to... I agree with what she's saying, that the meditation is bringing a lot of... It's making it easier to me to be with myself, for sure.
Beautiful. Thank you. And the other thing about being is when you have enough solitude or enough alone time, it gives you enough time to face yourself and see yourself. So, because otherwise it's so easy to get distracted, or it's so easy to have the mind spinning. And if the mind is spinning, it's hard to really see deeply. But you need a fair amount of time for the spinning mind to stop. And when the spinning mind stops, then you can see much more and face much more.
Sometimes my heart, even like if I need to think about something, and it beats really fast because I get really like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But then I think of you.
That quiets you down?
Like he told me, it'll be all right.
So it's behind you up there.
For me, death of a partner, and having to make that life change where I had a very full life, and then I found myself alone. And I think what got me through it was acceptance, that this is just the way it has to be. And over time, and with meditation practice, I learned to love it, where it was very difficult at first because it was such a huge change. I realized I had to do something. I mean, this was it, right? I didn't have a choice. And but the meditation made it really very wonderful. And so
Can you say
now? I love it.
Can you say maybe a few simple things about what was it about meditation that helped you love solitude?
It helped me to relax and accept that the death was traumatic, and so the meditation helped me to relax and feel a little bit more at peace. And then I began to be able to look inside. Once I felt at peace, I could then start looking at myself, and it wasn't so scary.
Great, beautiful. Thank you very much.
Maybe sort of along those lines, of course, not nearly the same, but for me it was the loss of a relationship that I thought would go on forever. I thought it was permanent. And when that it was quite a while ago, and when that relationship ended, well, 5 years, that's quite a while, no, seven, good. So anyway, when that ended, I'm more of a social person. I'm more extroverted. I like to be around people. And when that ended, I felt like the other person took me with them. Mm. And it's almost like my identity had become so wrapped up in this other person that I didn't even know who I was anymore. So at that time, I had enough sense about me to recognize that I needed to do something to change that. And so for me, I ended up responding by spending a lot of time by myself while the other person was out doing the opposite. And what was interesting is years later, that person came back to me at the end of the relationship that followed ours and said that they realized they had never dealt with the end of our relationship, and yet I had. And so that was kind of an interesting point. Just spending time by myself was important for me, and following that, my relationships were less codependent as a result.
Beautiful. Thank you. All the way in the corner.
For me, it's about slowing down, being mindful, and seeing the details of life. Is just about removing myself from the pace, the everyday pace of life, and putting myself in a place where I can be mindful about every little detail of what I'm doing, being mindful of just very simple things in life, and just, you know, doing the dishes or just mundane things, and just seeing feeling just peaceful about just being slow and deliberate and mindful about everything.
So that's possible. That's more likely when you're solitary, when you're alone.
Right. There's no distraction. There's it's very.
So you can really be present for the details of life in a way that's very deep, very meaningful and enjoyable.
Right.
Even as simple as washing a dishes becomes meaningful.
Right.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I'm actually one of the people who likes solitude. But I had a project in sort of high mountain wilderness where I was all alone with this big project. And it was hell. Because I wasn't at all alone. I had things to do and achieve, and I had that critical, managing, manipulating agenda. And there was no one else around. There was the amount of noise that my mind created to occupy the space of endless silence was overwhelming. And when I started to try and do something about it with my meditation, I just made it worse. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of trying to manage or make things other just got in the way of any kind of solitude. Just that sense of presence was absent with all of that activity.
Did you eventually find your peace with it?
Yeah, I went downtown to the city.
Yeah, it reminds me that I spent many years at the San Francisco Zen Center, And you know, not only is a place, you know, a monastery, a place to practice, but it's also a community. And as a community, you know, all the various kinds of dynamics of community come into play, and it gets pretty complicated, the community life and politics of it all. So then I went to, at one point I went to Burma to practice there, and I practiced basically alone for 8 months. It was a big monastery with lots of people, but I was given I didn't really talk to anybody for 8 months except for the interview with a meditation teacher. But once a day I had a 10-minute interview, and I was given a little room. And so I mostly practiced for those 8 months in a room by myself. And so it was pretty solitary. And lots of intensive meditations. All I did was meditate. And after being there about 3 months, I was pretty concentrated, pretty still, pretty in some ways deep, if you allow that kind of metaphor, pretty deep in my mind, my heart. And there in the deep recesses of my heart came up, I started having conversations with people at Zen Center. Like, you know, I mean, not just, not ordinary conversations, but like the politics of Zen Center and the positions and what job was I going to get when I came back, because you got status from your job and what people there thought, you know, certain particular people thought of me. And I kind of looked at my corners of my mind and said, how did Zen Center get in so deep? How did it get so deep into my psyche? There's no business being in there. And so, and then I kind of made a vow at the time. So, okay, I'm not going to go back to Zen Center until I get Zen Center out of my mind. You know, the conditioning was so deep, the habit or whatever. So the idea of, you know, taking all these people, we take all these people with us when we go to be alone. Okay, so I want to read two quotes, somewhat well-known quotes, I think. One is from Rilke. I hold this to be the highest task for a bond between two people, that each protects the solitude of the other. And that's very provocative, I think. Sometimes when we think about being together in intimate relationships, the idea is to be, you know, codependent. The idea is to be kind of, you know, there's a place where we lose our solitude and kind of join together. And so the idea that each protects the solitude of the other. And is it possible that if there's a healthy sense of solitude, maybe the people can meet more deeply? And then Japanese nun from the 10th century named Izumi Shikibu. She wrote, "Watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." So then Japanese poetry, all these ideas are symbolic in many ways. Watching the moon at dawn is watching her own mind. The fullness, clarity, emptiness of her own mind. Watching yourself at dawn, solitary, I knew myself completely, no part left out. I like this. I like what I like is that it ends with no part left out. So can you be present? Can you be solitary and present and whole in that? Not escaping into solitude, because then you're not whole. And not avoiding it, because if you avoid solitude, you're also not whole. But how to have the ability to be here in a full, radiant, complete way, no part left out. So that's the introduction for this three-part series. And if we have the capacity to stand alone, be alone in a healthy way, and be comfortable being alone, being silent, then that'll help us be much better listeners. And the world needs better listeners. And so then next week I'll talk about the art or the practice of listening. And so I hope that this week that you explore your relationship to solitude, and the challenges you have with that, and the benefits that you have with that, and the joys of that, And perhaps in this, I don't know how many of you live your lives, but many people have this amazingly interconnected world we live in now in a way that's not healthy, with computers and cell phones and iPods and texting and television and all this stuff. And, people can spend hours and hours and hours physically alone, not connecting, physically not near anybody at all, but they're completely plugged in. And that's not really solitude. That's not beautiful solitude. I think beautiful solitude is found probably by turning all those devices off. So maybe you can turn a few devices off this week and see what you find. So anyway, thank you very much.